welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And what would you say this episode is like, Annie?
Box chocolates. Because you never know what you're going to get. Except probably some chocolate history.
Yeah, maybe some chocolate science. A few sad things about chocolate.
Yeah.
Heads up, it's sad.
It is. We're going to get that out of the way right at the front. I guess you have some idea what to expect. And big thanks to listener Frida, who suggested this forever ago, and she sent us some really useful resources to check out, which was very useful.
Yes. That's all suggestions are welcome. Suggestions plus resources, even more so.
Mm-hmm. And recommendation, if you haven't listened to an episode on vanilla, you might want to go do that, because the histories of these things are, like, so intertwined.
Oh, absolutely. And even sugar a little bit, too.
Yeah.
That, because there's a lot of, yes, you'll see.
You'll see. Alexandra Leaf, who runs Chocolate Tours of New York City, describes chocolate as, quote, the best known food that nobody knows anything about.
Huh.
So what is it?
Chocolate. What is it?
It depends.
Oh.
Kind of. First, a couple of terminology notes, because it can get a little messy. So cacao usually describes the beans or plants before any processing has been done.
Mm-hmm.
It's large. The cacao nib or bean or seed is surrounded by the cacao fruit. It's really big. The plethora of stuff made with the beans is chocolate. Processed. If it's been processed, it's chocolate. And cocoa is the powdered form. Except sometimes the British use cocoa instead of cacao, and that really threw me off.
Confuses lots of articles. It's pretty, you know.
Yeah.
The British.
Always making things more complicated and interesting. Chocolate, the umbrella term, now includes a lot of products that are more sugar additives now than cacao, which
mm-hmm.
is a Star Wars reference for anybody. Anyway,
oh.
The cacao.
Oh, no, I got it. I'm caught up. Excellent.
The cacao that is in there more often than not comes from the least flavorful but most sturdy of cacao beans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's changing as societally we shift to that whole bean to bar, more flavor, more sustainable kind of thing. But, you know, something to keep in mind.
Yeah. A little bit more about that in just a moment.
Yeah. As we discussed in the vanilla episode, the root of the word chocolate goes back to chocolatl, the Aztec word for a bitter drink made from cacao. And vanilla helped sweeten the drink. And that's one of the reasons it was so popular, both vanilla and cacao, and especially them together. The Latin root of Theobroma cacao, the cacao tree, translates to food of the gods.
Yes, divine food. Mm-hmm. One of many.
Yes. And there's a rumor about it, isn't there, Lauren?
Oh, yes. That Carl Linnaeus, who formalized the system of naming organisms in the 1700s, named it so after having read this French medical thesis on chocolate. Medical thesis on chocolate. I love it.
Yeah.
Which suggested that it is so rad that it should be the nourishment of the gods rather than nectar or ambrosia. But it could, you know, it could be either, both.
Yeah. Why do you have to just pick one?
It's divine in general.
Mm-hmm. So what about the cacao tree? What's going on there?
It is a tropical tree. It needs warm, rainy kind of conditions and a lot of shade in order to do its thing. And there are three main varieties of cacao trees. The hardy forastero, the finicky but more complex flavored Creole, and the Trinitario, which is a hybrid of the two.
That kind of sounds like every fairy tale about three siblings, you know?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You're right. I think, all right. Let's write. Can we write some children's storybooks? Is that a thing?
You know that I'm making it a thing.
I have a whole plan, actually, for a whole other children's story. Anyway, this is outside the realm of chocolate. So let's talk about harvesting those tasty, tasty beans. Okay. The flowers of the cacao tree grow directly on the tree's trunks. The resulting fruit, often called pods, are these largish oblong things, sort of like a slightly deflated ribbed football. And that's the American football, not like a football, not like a soccer ball.
Okay.
It's sort of like someone stretched out a pumpkin.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh.
And they can come in green or yellow or orange or red as they grow. And then they will change colors as they ripen. And they don't have to start as green and wind up as red. They can kind of go the other way. It gets confusing, apparently. Unlike many fruits, they can grow year-round, and a single tree will usually have a bunch of pods at different stages of growth. inside those pods, there's this sort of gooey, sweet white pulp surrounding some 20 to 50 seeds, which are the cocoa beans.
Mm-hmm.
When the pods are ripe, the spotting of which, like I said, can be tricky and is a job for experienced farmers, they are cut from the tree by the stem. The farmers then split the pods open with either a hammer or a club, which is the preferred method but goes a little bit slower, or a machete, which, as you may imagine, is quicker but could damage the beans.
Sure.
And then you remove the beans plus some or all of the pulp. At this stage, the beans are light-colored and don't really have a lot of flavor. In order to make that happen, we need fermentation!
What?
Bacteria poop is involved in chocolate.
We're talking about bacteria poop again?
Again.
In chocolate?
I feel like someone's already gotten to bingo like
yeah, just straight
4
out
minutes
of the gate.
In. Yeah. All right. So, here we go. The workers lay out these pulpy beans in heaps or in boxes and then cover them to keep them warm and moist. The pulp around the beans liquefies, and the beans kind of just soak in that broth for 5 to 7 days, with the workers stirring and draining it occasionally. During the first 24 hours or so, the seeds actually germinate and begin growing, and those wee baby plants' enzymes convert all of the pulp's sucrose to glucose and fructose. With that high-energy food available, a whole bunch of bacteria and yeasts and other fungi go to proverbial town. Those microorganisms, by the way, get in there thanks to contact with workers' hands and all the equipment that is used and reused. Cross-contamination in the best possible way. The germs also produce heat, which can reach like 50 degrees Celsius, a.k.a. 122 Fahrenheit, and is enough to kill the plant embryo and basically any unwanted microorganisms. Among these bugs are our old friends, Saccharomyces cerevisiae.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to learn how to say that.
One day.
One of these years. That's brewer's yeast, which is much nicer to say. And various species of lactobacillus, a.k.a. Lactic acid bacteria. These yeasts help break down the pectin covering the seeds, which lets kind of two bitter compounds leak out and allows the alcohol created by the yeasts and the bacteria to seep in, along with all kinds of alcohol-soluble flavor compounds that are also excreted by the microbes. 5 days into the process, this gloop can contain up to a trillion microbes per gram.
That is a lot.
That is tasty.
So, tasty, tasty science.
Tasty gloop science microbes, absolutely. So you want to stop this whole process before those microbes begin growing in or on the beans instead of just the pulp, because those bacteria and fungi can break down some of the fats in the beans and cause all kinds of weird off flavors.
Mm-hmm.
So you dry the beans out. You get them graded as either fine or flavor beans or as bulk or ordinary beans, and then you ship them off for manufacturing. The first step of which is roasting them to 121 Celsius, a.k.a. about 250 Fahrenheit, which kills off any remaining microbes and also brings out a lot of those flavor and aroma compounds. At the roasting stage, the beans still have a husk on them, so they're shelled and then crushed into nibs, little kernels of bean. Those nibs or kernels can be sold as is or ground into paste, sometimes called chocolate liqueur, not like chocolate liqueur, like the stuff you would drink.
Right.
More confusion. For further processing. The paste is about half and half fats and solids. If you remove some of the fats, which are cocoa butter, from the paste, the remaining solids are cocoa powder. Cocoa butter is often used to give some of the creaminess and flavor to chocolate candies. It's also the only part of the cacao plant that's actually in white chocolate. And it is used, of course, on its own or mixed with any number of things in the cosmetic industry.
And speaking of white chocolate, brief rundown, very brief, of chocolate types.
Yeah.
So you've got the unsweetened cocoa powder, unsweetened baking or bitter chocolate made only of ground up cocoa beans, dark chocolate, which contains no milk solids, bittersweet chocolate has to have at least 35% cocoa solids, most have about 50%. You've got semi-sweet, which apparently is a mostly American term made up by Nestle. You've got milk chocolate, which has either condensed milk or dry milk solids, and white chocolate, as mentioned, only cocoa butter, and some don't even have that.
Oh.
Yeah.
How
check it out.
Dare you?
Yeah.
All right.
There are more, but those are the basics. And thanks to thespruce.com for the handy breakdown.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Spruce is a great resource for many, many things. Mm-hmm. One quick note here, though. As we talk about all these different types of candy type things, candy making science is not what we are talking about here today.
No.
It's the molecular stuff is really fascinating, but also a lot that was too much physics.
Yeah, which I am very excited. Apparently, Lauren, you've made truffles.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And know about tempering and, yeah.
It's super easy. Like I said before we started the podcast, it's super easy as long as you follow your instructions extremely exactly and don't get any water anywhere near it.
So I will fail. But I am down to try.
Yeah.
Yes, we won't be talking about that today. That's a future episode.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway.
Back to chocolate.
In general. Yeah.
Yeah. Côte d'Ivoire accounted for 20% of global cocoa production in 2015, which comes out to 60% of their export revenue. And today, we spend an annual $75 billion on chocolate. And in America, we eat an average 12 pounds of chocolate a year.
Whew.
The industry of chocolate manufacturing is valued at about $4 billion a year in the U.S. and worldwide, the chocolate candy, specifically candy industry, is worth $100 billion U.S. dollars. That's a lot of money.
That is. That's also a lot of 12 pounds of chocolate. That's a lot of chocolate. Except I feel like I probably eat more than that.
I don't know. I honestly would love to see a picture of a pound, what a pound looks like in terms of chocolate bars. Although I feel like I get most of my chocolate from baked goods, which is my weakness.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's harder.
Either way, there's a 100 grand pun in there, but it's a lot of chocolate. So what about the history? We'll talk about that after a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. So, on to the history.
Yes, as we said in our vanilla episode, chocolate leaves behind a handy-dandy chemical residue, and that residue happens to be theobromine, or bromine, which can be found in all kinds of really old stuff.
It can, including a 5,500-year-old ceramic and a piece of mortar discovered in southern Ecuador. Historians think that shamans native to the area ground up cacao for use in hallucinogenic potions.
Ah.
Yes. If we're talking linguistic evidence, by 1900 BCE, pre-Olmec cultures living in what is now Mexico were producing chocolate. And by chocolate, we mean they were taking the cacao beans and fermenting them, bacteria poop, yay, roasting them and then grinding them up between two stones with a fire underneath and mixing the resulting paste with things like vanilla, honey, chili peppers, and water. And the final product was a frothy, and everywhere I read used that word, so it must have been pretty frothy, chocolate drink that was meant to be more invigorating and less sweet and comforting like the way we view our hot chocolate today.
Yeah, absolutely. It was also an important preservation process for the beans because by itself, the chocolate paste would last maybe a couple of weeks, but they could also harden and dry it out into these like tablets for storage and then reconstitute them up to 2 years later.
Just pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the primary way people consumed chocolate for centuries as a drink, a bitter drink that would put a pep in your step. And of course, it was seen as an aphrodisiac. Bingo! Because of its perceived mood and libido boosting, both the Aztec and the Maya revered chocolate as a gift from the gods. Specifically, the feathered serpent god the Maya called Kukulcan and the Aztec Quetzalcoatl. Chocolate was often a part of royal feast, ceremonies, or sacred rituals, and until 1737, cacao beans were used as currency. 100 of them would get you a fancy turkey.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Ties into so many other episodes.
I know. Aztec sacrifice victims, who were too bummed out to participate in the pre-sacrifice festivities, what was wrong with them, they were given a gourd of chocolate to lift their spirits.
Oh.
And the chocolate had the blood of past victims in it, so quite spirited indeed. That works on two terrible levels.
Oh, Thank you, Annie. We can always count on you.
Count. Oh, no. Okay, anyway. Pottery with cacao residue unearthed in Honduras goes back as far as 1400 BCE, and historians think that the people at the time made an alcoholic beverage by fermenting the pulp, encasing the cacao beans.
Later on, around about the BCE-CE switchover, the pulp was a staple food for the Maya.
The Aztec had difficulty growing cacao, so they traded with the Maya, and according to a few sources, in the 16th century, Aztec Emperor Montezuma drank 3 gallons of this stuff a day to achieve maximum libido.
Sounds like an 80s movie.
It really does. I'm going to design the cover for it after this.
Oh, I'm so excited.
It's going to be excellent. Speaking of Montezuma, as we've mentioned in previous episodes, he purportedly welcomed Spanish explorer Hernan Cortez, his arrival in 1519 or 1520, with, among other things, chocolate. Like 50 jugs of it.
Poured, like a whole bunch.
Yeah, a lot. And it was poured and served in golden cups. Which is, I think, pretty regularly you drink at the time. You had your chocolate in a golden cup.
Chocolate in a golden cup.
Mm-hmm. In some versions of this story, Montezuma believed Cortez to be a deity reincarnated.
Like coming back over the sea. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing. It might be apocryphal. We're not sure.
Yeah. A lot of things we read and look into. Anyway, in the writings of both Columbus, and Cortez, they describe beans that were, quote, almond-like and that were used as currency. Cortez claimed that chocolate caffeinated those who drank it. And upon his arrival to Nicaragua on his fourth voyage, Columbus wrote that he was greeted by natives with a chocolate drink that was spicy and bittery. He probably didn't use those words, but that was essentially what he was saying. When Cortez returned to Europe with chocolate, leaving decimation in his wake, the Europeans didn't really go for it. As we mentioned in the vanilla episode, it was described in the Spanish writing of, I looked it up, Girolamo Benzoni as seemed more a drink for pigs than a drink for humanity.
Whew. Ouch.
Yeah. It wasn't sweet enough for their taste, but that was easily remedied by adding some honey or cane sugar and some cinnamon and later, yes, vanilla. Chocolate spread throughout Spain, but was still largely a drink for the rich and elite, often imbibed from fancy cups, engraved goblets, golden vessels. You weren't upper class if you didn't own some chocolate ware.
Yeah, specifically for the... Oh, I love that. I wish it hadn't gone out of fashion.
Would you have some chocolate ware, Lauren?
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
I drink it like once a year, but I don't know. I feel like that's about as often as I use my teapot.
Mm-hmm. Unsweetened chocolate was used medicinally for things like upset stomach, and oh yeah, they thought it was an aphrodisiac.
Of course.
Yeah. Casanova reportedly loved this stuff, possibly downing it after his daily breakfast of 60 morning oysters. Another episode reference.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I was thinking about this, and I suppose thanks to advertising and a successful misrepresentation of Mesoamerican culture as being this really sensual thing, chocolate is still seen as an aphrodisiac in Western culture, kind of.
Yeah, yeah, and it's sort of spread. I mean, Japan also has, like, Valentine's Day traditions of
right.
gifting chocolate to each other, although I'm not sure how much of that is perpetuated in,
sure.
you know, the greeting card industry versus...
Yeah.
Actual thought.
Greeting card industry. While Cortez brings the Spanish chocolate as the predominant theory, it relies on some assumption. According to Sophie and Michael Coe's book, The True History of Chocolate, the first evidence of chocolate in Spain was when friars introduced it to Prince Philip. And it would make sense for friars to have access to cacao, too, since they were still being used in Mesoamerica for rituals and religious ceremonies. And the friars might pocket them and or sell them, too. Whatever the case, trade records from the 1580s document regular deliveries of chocolate to Spain. Since cacao really prefers a tropical lowland climate, they relied on long-distance trade for their supply. Some accounts say the first chocolate shop opened in Spain around this time, but there isn't definitive proof. The first substantive proof of that in Spain, a chocolate shop that is in the 1630s when mostly female vendors might sell small amounts of chocolate out of stands in places like Madrid.
Okay, but so we're saying that nobody really liked it that much at the time. Why go to all this trouble?
I know. I guess it had to do with the dependence of the Spanish settling in the New World. They depended on these local goods, and despite massively decreasing the indigenous population with disease and violence, the Spanish were still the minority, and Spanish women exponentially so. This, along with a calculated strategy of using marriage and other domestic situations to further their dominance, meant that there was a lot of, like, mashing up and exchanging of cultures and ideas, often coerced. Mm-hmm. In Mesoamerica at the time, women typically made the chocolate, and elite Spaniards married to these women, or who knew these women as the servants that raised their children, learned to like the stuff. When the Spaniards returned to Europe, brimming with tales of their conquest, the aristocracy wanted to emulate them, and then people wanted to emulate the aristocracy, and so on.
It's one of those interesting cases, and is pointed out by a terrific article that we came across, the name of which I don't have right in front of me. That's pointing out that it's one of the bottom-up absorptions of a cultural idea versus a top-down kind of thing, which is the way that a lot of things go. You know, like a queen says, I'm going to wear this white dress, and all of a sudden we're all wearing white dresses at weddings.
Exactly. And kind of related, the love of chocolate in the New World by both the indigenous and the Spanish sparked rumors of sorcery, that the women used the chocolate they made to bewitch people.
Chocolate witches!
Mm-hmm, because if there is an opportunity to accuse a woman of being a witch, why not? By golly, why not, says history. Several Inquisition documents and cases cite chocolate's alleged use in love potions, cures, spells. Spanish author Juan de Cardenas said about saving chocolate from paganism, as he said, by advocating its use in the context of old, old world medicine, because that was okay.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's full of all the, you know, leeches and humors and everything that we're comfortable with.
Exactly. And speaking of humors, he gave it a humor profile, which is not nearly as fun as it sounds. Mine would be something like bad puns.
Oh, yeah. No. Humors meaning the liquids that make up our universe, or the substances, rather.
And I can't wait to do an episode on that, because I do not know much about it at all.
Oh, it's terrifying. I love it. Okay.
I read some of this guy's book, and it was quite offensive. It didn't accomplish what he wanted to either, because there was an anxiety about chocolate spreading the culture of the New World for a long time after.
Huh.
In 1619, a Spanish physician wrote in his book that Spanish women used chocolate, quote, to give occasion to avenge their jealousies, learning and using spells from Indian women who are the great masters, having been taught by the devil. And to be clear, this wasn't a medical book. He was a physician, but it wasn't a medical book. And that was the dialogue of a character known as the Indian. But that's a taste of some of the racism that came attached with chocolate and liking chocolate at the time.
Huh.
Yeah. Spain did manage to keep chocolate close to the chest until the 1615 wedding of the daughter of Spanish King Philip III to French King Louis XIII, and France got a taste of chocolate. Royal courts and aristocracy across Europe embraced chocolate, and soon it was all the rage, a fashionable drink that may cure your ailments and increase your libido, all while showing off how rich and luxurious your lifestyle was. Before coffee or tea, chocolate was the original stimulant drink in Europe.
And even when coffee and tea did hit the scene, drinking chocolate was at least as popular, even though it was more than twice as expensive.
Mm-hmm.
It was so popular, in fact, that the Roman Catholic Church basically waved it in as okay to drink during fasts, because they were afraid that if they didn't, they would drive off some of their wealthiest practitioners.
And seriously, it was so popular. People used to throw these chocolate parties. And chocolate didn't have the same gendering that coffee and tea did, so it was relatively more equal opportunity chocolate parties.
Mm-hmm.
Also, tea was gendered feminine in Europe because it was from Asia.
Oh my gosh.
Future episode, I got so mad.
Oh, wow. I didn't. Okay. All right. I'm back at the microphone.
Yeah. I never even thought about it.
That's really. Anyway. Okay. Here we go.
The increase in popularity of chocolate, of course, meant an increase in demand, and that meant the establishment of European plantations, because, of course, the rest of imperialist Europe wasn't going to let Spain dominate the cacao trade.
Of course not.
And they set these up in the Caribbean, Mesoamerica, islands off Africa's coast during the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries to grow and harvest the time-consuming and labor-intensive cacao. And these plantations were often powered with slave labor. Sugar and vanilla were tied up in this as well, since those were two of the chocolate enhancers of choice. African slaves were brought in once the native Mesoamerican laborers were all but wiped out by European diseases.
Whew. Through all this...
Yeah. Spain was importing thousands of pounds of cacao and chocolate per year by the 1620s. And in the 30 years between 1620 and 1650, Venezuela exported 31,000 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And from 1650 to 1700, that number shot up to 7 million pounds.
But there is a reason why Spain is not the country that you perhaps think of when you think of the chocolate industry in Europe.
That's true. The Dutch were the first European power to break Spain's hold on cacao, both by capturing the island of Curaçao in 1634 and by smuggling cacao to Amsterdam. Not long after that, the Dutch became Europe's main supply for cacao.
And it was around this time, that the latter half of the 17th century, that Europeans were making solid chocolate candies as well as just drinking chocolates. They were evaporating the drinking chocolate into these solid candies.
Mm-hmm. And during America's Revolutionary War, chocolate was used as wages and it was included in the soldiers' rations.
Folks were still using chocolate for medicinal purposes at the time, though. In 1826, our friend Brillat Savarin described chocolate with ambergris as the chocolate of the afflicted. Ambergris, by the way, is a sort of musky-smelling, waxy stuff that was popular in perfume and medicine at the time, and it comes from the guts of sperm whales, where it forms like a bezoar from the undigested beaks of the squid that they eat.
That's fantastic.
Oh, man, perfumery. Okay. Anyway, our French buddy recommended this mixture to, quote, any man who has drunk too deeply of the cup of pleasure, who finds his wit temporarily losing its edge, or who is tortured by a fixed idea.
Wow.
Drink some chocolate and sperm whale stuff.
Yeah.
Get better.
We really have been trying to cure the hangover for a long time, haven't we? Chocolate became more accessible in 1828 when Conrad Johannes van Houten, a Dutch chemist, came up with the idea for the cocoa press. And basically what this press did was take roasted cacao beans and squeeze out about half the cocoa butter, leaving behind a dry cake-like thing that was then pulverized into a powder. This powder, called Dutch cocoa, was often mixed with other things to cut the bitterness, like alkaline salts and liquids. Very key, because this meant you could mold and solidify chocolate into individual pieces, and it also lowered the cost of chocolate, making it even more readily available to more people.
Mm-hmm.
And helping to lower the price was the removal of chocolate tax in Europe at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
That'll do it. Joseph Fry of British chocolate company J.S. Fry & Sons made the first chocolate bar in 1847, a combination of cocoa butter, cocoa powder, and sugar. And then along comes the company Cadbury.
Wait, that Cadbury?
Yes, that Cadbury, with boxes of chocolates available for purchase in England by 1868, followed in a couple of years by Nestle.
Hmm.
Yep, that one. They had a milk chocolate bar with the help of powdered milk's introduction in 1875. Silkier, smoother chocolate was made possible by Rudolf Lentz's invention of the conching machine in 1879.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Family-owned, yes, that one, companies, Hershey and Mars, got in the game soon after.
Wait, Mars was a dude? Mars was, like, a family name?
Yeah.
What?
I have to say, several times when I was reading scientific research about chocolate, and it was like, research from Mars, and I thought, they're researching chocolate on Mars? How? And then I realized, Mars isn't quite as popular in the U.S., I suppose, as it is in Europe. I don't know. Random spoutings in the middle of a podcast. With the 20th century, demand only increased, which put more and more strain on the equator-adjacent regions that are capable of growing this stuff. The average cacao farmer makes $2 a day.
And that's like today, not like...
Yeah, this is modern. Mm-hmm. We're talking modern now. Several of the plantations West African countries use that provide a good chunk of cacao supply for big companies use child and slave labor, impacting an estimated 2 million children, working with chainsaws and other dangerous tools like machetes, industrial chemicals used to keep away insects. And there are truly horrific stories from people who were forced to work on cacao farms as children.
Yeah.
One of the children who worked on one said in a BBC documentary on the subject, "When people eat chocolate, they are eating my flesh." Some companies are working with the African countries to reduce this number. Ferraro, for example, has set a date of 2020 to get rid of slavery at the farms and plantations that it uses for cacao. Mars, as in the company, not the planet, has set a similar benchmark. Several big hitters in the chocolate world came together to form the nonprofit group, the International Cocoa Initiative, with the goal of finding some solutions, but it's slow goings.
Yeah, it's one of those really unfortunate situations where people at multiple points in the chain have a opportunity to profit, and so it's difficult to get changes enacted.
Right. And unfortunately, there's currently no real way for consumers to consistently know whether or not slave labor went into their chocolate. Labels like Fair Trade can't guarantee that those products were made without slave labor. Fortune has a good breakdown of what the big companies are doing if you want to know more. And there's a blog post on Huffington Post with a list of child labor-free chocolate companies and things we can do as consumers. Just basically get informed, get your friends informed, and let the companies know this is not okay. It is a huge and complex problem that involves poverty and so much moving pieces.
Yeah, yeah. And so, right, doing research is basically the best you can do. We'll try to send out some of those links that we were just talking about on social media after this episode airs.
Yes, absolutely. And on that depressing but completely necessary note, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. So this brings us to our science-y, healthy, kind of manufacturing-y sort of section here. In other words that I haven't Joss Whedoned like that. So first of all, is chocolate a drug?
Is it?
Well, yes. Some historians think that it was only ever accepted in Europe because it was presented as a medicine, though their standards for medicines could be pretty low. It depends on your definition of a drug. Cacao contains a bunch of different psychoactive compounds, meaning chemicals that do stuff to the stuff that your brain is doing. Okay? So it's got stimulants like caffeine, which speeds up nerve cell activity and constricts blood vessels in the brain, which can cure headaches. And as a byproduct of the nerve cell activity, can cause a release of adrenaline, which affects your blood flow and muscle tension, and thus can help with stuff like cramps. There's also theobromine, which increases your heart rate and widens your blood vessels. There's also a couple of pleasure producers in there, cannabinoids. Yes, the same kind of thing that's in marijuana, which can decrease pain sensitivity and trigger euphoric pleasure hormones like neoepinephrine and dopamine in the brain. Also, there's phenylethylamine, which does very similar things. And vaguely in this category are fats and sugars, which may stimulate opiate production in the brain. More on that thing in our sugar episodes.
I was just thinking that it might be kind of an association that you build.
Yeah.
When you eat chocolate and then...
That is... Sugary, yeah. Mm-hmm. However, many chocolate candies do not contain a whole lot of those things, except maybe the fats and sugars part. Although some of the compounds may be working together to create a greater effect than they otherwise would on their own. For example, some research has indicated that the effects of caffeine and cannabinoids together can create a greater effect, which, although it is illicit in many of these our United States, may be why marijuana and chocolate are packaged in the same package sometimes. But The amount of caffeine in chocolate isn't anything to be worried about as long as you're snacking in moderation. A single cup of coffee, for example, can butt you up pretty close to the recommended limit of caffeine per day, which is 200 milligrams. That's set out by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. But in terms of chocolate, even high cocoa chocolate only ranges to about 60 milligrams per every 2 ounces. That's 50 grams of chocolate. You're probably going to be fine.
Here's another headline about chocolate.
Oh, yeah.
Is my dog going to die of chocolate poisoning?
Ah! I hope not.
Yeah.
It is true that dogs and cats should not eat chocolate. But dogs and cats process theobromine more slowly than humans, which means that they can eat more of it than their adorable fuzzy bodies can safely process fairly quickly. But, again, most chocolate doesn't contain that much. I mean, like, don't feed your dog a pound of chocolate. It's not good for anybody. But if your dog gets into some candy or baked goods or ice cream, probably the worst thing that's going to happen is minor digestive issues. If your dog has eaten chocolate and then acts nervous or shaky or refuses other food or has continued digestive issues, definitely call a vet. And if you're worried either way or if your dog is very small, go on and call a vet anyway, just to be sure you're doing all you can, because the theobromine can create stroke-like conditions in animals. That's the problem there, and that's not what anybody wants for a pupper. And on to nutrition.
Nutrition stuff.
So perhaps obviously the nutritional properties of chocolate depend on the cocoa to cocoa butter ratio and what you've mixed them with, including sugars and creamy things like milk. Cocoa nibs on their own are a high-calorie food. They're about 130 calories per ounce, which is 28 grams. And composition-wise, they're 85% fat. But they also contain some 12% protein and a lot of dietary fiber and essentially no sugar. So in moderation, this, the cocoa nibs, the purest form of the cacao plant that you can get, are pretty good for you. It'll fill you up fast and has, you know, a little bit of protein. However, even high cocoa dark chocolate is significantly more sugary. Generally, the less cocoa and more sweeteners and creamy things that are involved in chocolates, the more of a treat they should be considered. But it's not like you're eating chocolate for your health, are you?
Well,
Wait. Are you?
People certainly have been.
There are a lot of health claims and studies out there about chocolate and cacao's component chemicals, some of which are flavonoids, which are a group of antioxidant compounds that have been associated with lower risks of cardiovascular conditions like heart attacks and strokes, plus lower risks of diseases like cancer and diabetes under particular conditions. For example, one study of the Kuna people in Panama, who drink as many as 40 cups of their traditional bitter cocoa per week, develop those aforementioned diseases and conditions at lower rates, and in the case of cancer, much lower rates than other people from Panama. But there are some problems with this and other studies into chocolate's potential health benefits. First of all, the studies are often at least partially funded by or otherwise connected to confectionery giants like the aforementioned Mars Incorporated. Doesn't necessarily mean that their results are wrong, but it is a thing to keep in mind. Secondly, the amount of flavanols actually present in consumer chocolate products depends on the beans themselves, on how hot they get during manufacturing, on how much any dairy in your chocolate is interfering with the flavanol uptake, which is a thing that happens, and how much cocoa solid is actually in your finished chocolate product. For example, there, one study in 2004 showed that with just 2 weeks of eating 1.6 ounces of a high flavanol chocolate per day, that improved the function of participants' blood vessels' inner walls. But what on earth counts as a high flavanol chocolate? For that, we have to turn to the future! We both even kind of looked in the same direction when we did that. That's nice.
I think that's called America Face.
Oh, yeah?
I think that's a thing. I'm pretty sure.
Okay. I believe you.
We both just did America Face. All right. So the future. What's going on?
Researchers are working on manufacturing processes that can retain more of cocoa's flavanols. And meanwhile, back on the raw production end, other researchers are working on developing higher-yield cacao trees, which is good Because they're pretty finicky plants, and some 30 to 40% of the world's crop has traditionally been lost every year to disease and pests.
And hip, hip, hooray, climate change is making this worse because warming warming climates, they allow for more diseases and pest breeding. And also weather extremes are bad.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, there's a lack of genetic diversity, which means if one strain of cacao bean is susceptible, probably a lot of them are.
Mm-hmm.
A few years back, scientists sequenced the genome researchers believe is responsible for 96% of our cacao. Scientists are applying this data to all sorts of things, like increasing yield and increasing disease resistance. So a lot of things being worked on there.
Yeah. Folks are also working on sussing out the complete microbiology of the chocolate fermentation process in order to reduce waste from unwanted microbe growth and to make tastier and tastier chocolate all the time.
That's just good. I don't know if you've heard this. You probably have. Chocolate, I'm learning, attracts a lot of these headlines, these disastrous.
Oh, yeah.
But I've heard that there will be no real chocolate by 2020, and I was expecting to, like, find something about that. And I did find something kind of about it, but it seems more like if we don't do anything, then eventually we won't have chocolate. But we are doing stuff.
Yeah.
So.
And it's, I mean, I don't know. It's really hard to predict exactly what kind of effects climate change is going to have on single areas like this.
Yes, that is true. But, you know, let's talk about candy.
Oh, yeah. And one more big scary headline.
Yeah. Is it true I'm eating insect legs?
What? is that a thing?
Did you not? Have you never heard this before?
I think I had. But
it was big when I was in elementary school.
Oh, no. I think I just ignored it.
Yeah,
I,
you were like, psh.
Yeah. I'm like, I eat insect legs all the time.
That's just how I roll.
Insect leg Lauren, that's what they call me on the playground.
What a nickname. According to an FDA compliance policy guideline first published in 1985 and last revised in 2000 titled Chocolate and Chocolate Liqueur. Adulteration with insect and rodent filth. The FDA can seize any chocolate if 6 separate subsamples of 100 grams, or about 2 regular-sized chocolate bars, have over 60 insect fragments on average, or if any single of those subsamples has 90 or more insect fragments. For rodents, if you're interested, it's an average of 1 rodent hair, 1.0 rodent hair, from 6 100-gram subsamples, or if any single 100-gram sample has 3 rodent hairs. And apparently this story was big in 2012, although, like I said, I first heard about it in elementary school. And when the news outlets were reporting it, they were saying that if you had a chocolate allergy, what you were reacting to was the insect parts, specifically cockroach insect parts. However, chocolate is not alone in this. It's really, really hard to avoid insect parts in your food completely. And attempting to do so would be worse for your health, most likely, since it happens at the source and would require using more pesticides.
Yeah, like seriously, I know that 1.5 hairs per chocolate bar sounds like a drastically large amount of rodent hair to be allowable. But if you're squeamish about insects or other pest waste like that, probably just never read any of the FDA's or any other governing body's regulations about how much pest contamination per part is allowed in any food, and definitely never get a job in the food industry. There are lots of things that humans can and, in fact, often do to prevent this sort of contamination, but pests do happen no matter how careful we are. Furthermore, if you are allergic to cockroaches, chocolate is probably not the greatest of your worries. It is a fairly common allergy to have. Studies have found that of humans who have allergies, anywhere from 4.7 to 12.5% may be sensitive to cockroach allergens, something I did not know.
No,
especially because cockroaches are heckin' everywhere. In the United States, the rate of homes possessing detectable levels of cockroach allergens ranges between 30% in, like, wealthy, spaced-out suburbs and 85% in poorer, more crunched-in urban areas, which is a thing that we all basically just have to be okay with because cockroaches aren't going anywhere. You can take steps in your own home by keeping everything clean and dry and uncluttered and by using stuff like traps if it's safe for you and your pets and your kids.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of being okay with it, a few years ago in France, a chocolatier purposefully put bugs on his chocolates.
Like on?
Yeah, on.
Like not?
Not in it. On top. Mm-hmm. Like a decoration. They were a topping of crickets and worms dusted with gold. I got to read all about cricket diets in this because he was particular about what he would feed the crickets that he put on there.
Oh, wow.
And I can tell you, I was not expecting the research to go this way. Cricket diets in the chocolate episode.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's nothing more to say on that currently.
Not currently. But side note, if you are sensitive to chocolate and you do have other like sneezy, sniffly, rashy, migrainy allergies, it could be cockroaches.
It could be.
Yeah, maybe. Get a skin test from a doctor if you're concerned. However, if you're sensitive to gluten or have celiac disease, there's a protein in cocoa that's really similar in structure. So that could explain you're having a kind of digestive tract reaction to chocolate. Some symptoms could also be due to dairy, caffeine, soy or nut sensitivities, or even nickel sensitivities, which cocoa and a lot of nuts that might be in chocolate bars are high in.
Hmm.
Or it could be the chocolate itself.
Oh.
If you have symptoms, especially like anaphylaxis-type symptoms, you know, difficulty breathing, hives, swelling in the mouth area, vomiting, definitely talk to an allergist and be careful about what you eat in the meanwhile.
I had a friend in middle school and high school, and she was allergic to chocolate, and she, you know, couldn't enjoy at parties and all this stuff. And when she was in high school, I think it was her older brother said it was a prank. Like, he just told her that, and that if she had some, she'd die, and she wasn't actually allergic.
What?
She was furious.
What? Years.
Years gone.
Oh, you never get that chocolate-eating life back.
Not as a kid. No way. I think about that often.
Oh, I'm going to think about it often now.
Mean but successful prank. Siblings, man. Siblings. Okay, so that's chocolate. It was quite the undertaking and definitely a lot more topics to explore there. But in the meantime,
listener mail.
We have two ramen emails.
Yes.
Bob sent us this. Eating dry ramen is quite common here in China and other Asian countries. Growing up, my son was always asking for mame noodles. I don't know, I think. Or one of the other brands of what is essentially just a bag of flavored dry ramen noodles. Also, oftentimes before work, when we were in Macau, I used to stop at a little restaurant by my office that served a lovely beef with black bean sauce served over crispy noodles, which, of course, was only broken block of dry ramen. So don't be embarrassed by munching on a block of dry ramen, as over here, no one would even blink at the idea.
Rose also wrote in, I have visited the Momofuku Endo Ramen Museum in Akeda, Osaka. Aside from displays of instant ramen through the years and a historical replica of Momofuku's workshop, the main focus of the museum is composing your own cup noodle. That's right. For about $350 US, circa 2008 anyway, you can choose up to three toppings and a soup base. You can also decorate your cup noodle package. It's then shrink-wrapped and put into a strange bag that I realized must have been developed for cup noodle space travel after I listened to your podcast. If you are a better planner than I was, you can also take a class on making your own instant chicken ramen noodles.
That sounds worth visiting for sure.
Yes. Oh, my own ramen flavors. I don't know what I would do.
I know. I think the indecision might overwhelm me.
Yeah, I can't even go into frozen yogurt places.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
We got in trouble doing that.
You got into a little bit more trouble than I did,
but
you were
really
going
did.
For the visuals. So.
I was. There's a whole video. You can find it online.
Yeah, it's in our yogurt video.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to both of them for writing in. If you
yes.
would like to write us, you can do so. Our email is foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at foodstuffhsw. We're also on Instagram at foodstuff. We hope to hear from you. We are so grateful to our amazing producer, Dylan Fagan, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.